Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we speak with Bob Avian, who is going to be opening A Chorus Line in London at the Palladium coming up in February. We talk to him about that and his career, as well as Chaplin opened up on Broadway and Forbidden Broadway as well. We review those too. So stay with us. And welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, September 16th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer who you could read at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays. He also writes for Critcherland on Fridays and in the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You could see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could also see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Michael also writes for outlets like NPR and ArtsAmerica.org. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So we are finally, the three of us, back together. It must be the fall, the beautiful, crisp September weather out there. And the season has kicked off, and both of you have gotten a chance to see Chaplin. So, Peter, why don't you start us off on Chaplin on Broadway?
Yeah, the new musical biography. We almost got one almost 30 years ago when Anthony Newley was going to do one. He did it out on the coast, and he co-wrote it as well. And I would like to have seen that one rather than this one. Sight unseen, I would think this one would have... that we have here can't compare to the one that Newley wrote, because this one just doesn't have much interest at all, I'm sorry to say, even though Tom Meehan's name's attached to it. Christopher Curtis obviously needed some help, and Tom Meehan came in, but I wish he had been more help, because this one just starts, continues, ends, and we all go home. There's not much to it, really. I'm sorry for Rob McClure, who's a very talented actor, and I've known him since the days he was at Montclair State, seeing him on stage in such productions as The Skin of Our Teeth and saying, wow, that kid's terrific. So I'm delighted that he's had this wonderful chance to headline a Broadway musical, but he just doesn't have the material. Now, usually when people say he just doesn't have the material, that means he has bad material. While his material isn't particularly good in the show, the real problem is it isn't particularly plentiful. I don't think there's been a title character, and I'm including Gypsy, who has less to sing than Rob McClure does in Chaplin. Now, I guess part of this is because they feel, oh, silent movie, you know, so let's have him move around a lot. But, you know, it is a musical, and it would be interesting to hear what was on Charlie Chaplin's mind while he was doing these routines. Sir, even in the times when he was supposedly, you know, a happy man, but wasn't. I mean, there's so many possibilities one can do for songs, but Rob McClure just doesn't get a chance to sing. He's very good in what he does. He's very good in aping Charlie Chaplin's walk and doing all sorts of little tricks, throwing a chair in the air and catching it in one hand. But all in all, it's such a dull show. And another thing that makes it duller, which would seem to be a good idea on paper, is that it's done in black and white until the end, when some color comes in. Don't expect Loveland from Follies. It doesn't turn into that. But throughout the show, there's a lot of black and white and gray and silver and that type of thing. And I understand the point of view of that. But nevertheless, watching it all night long in such gloomy lighting makes it a very dull experience, too. So that's a problem as well. Also, while Rob McClure does get a terrific hand with his 11 o'clock number, partly because we haven't heard him sing like this all night long. It's very interesting to me, the night I was there, Jen Colella, as Hedda Hopper, got the biggest hand of the night thus far when she did his number. And there's something wrong when the first number to tear down the house comes from Hedda Hopper, not from Charlie Chaplin. You know, there's a metaphor here. There's a scene where Charlie gets married. He's walking down the aisle with the bride. The bride throws her bouquet to the single women, and then they get married officially. He puts the ring on the finger, so on and so forth. I don't know about wedding receptions you've been to, but to me, it's always been a case where the bride gets her ring first and later throws the bouquet. I know this sounds trivial, but there is a point in which Charlie says to his brother, you know, these silent movies are even funnier if they're shown backwards. And he does that. We see the silent movies, and of course, seeing the silent movies, we're much more interested in the movies with the real Charlie Chaplin than we are in the aping of them. So I don't know. I think they got it backwards all the way through here by doing the black and white, by having a score that does not feature much singing from Charlie Chaplin. And for taking the whole life, you know, there's so much about his being obsessed with his mother. She was really uppermost in his thoughts and influenced so much of his work. Okay, fine, yeah. But there's also a great deal about how he neglected her and how his brother was really there for the mother and he was not. So I don't know how much we can really get behind all this angst about his mother when he doesn't seem to care as much as we would think that he would care. So he's very unlikable. There's a scene that I will never forget that I think is so putrid, where indeed he's working with Jackie Coogan, a little kid, in the movie The Kid. The kid's 4 or 5 years old, something like that. And the kid isn't giving him enough, not emoting enough, not crying enough. And he banishes the kid's mother from the set and says, your mother's never coming back. And the kid starts crying. And he doesn't even seem to be the least bit concerned that he has done this terrible thing to the kid. Even if he had a line of dialogue afterwards saying, well, it was the only thing I could do, you know. But he really seems to feel it is right and privileged to do that. And that's a good place where the audience turns against him. It's very hard not to. So I don't think this one's going to be with us very much longer, considering the fact that they don't have a real star, though they could have had one if they had given Rob McClure the right material. I wish the Anthony Newley's script and score would come in right now. They change everything. So that's my feeling on Chaplin.
Well, I totally agree about that thing with the kid. Do we have any idea if that's based in truth?
I couldn't find anything, and I looked.
It reminded me of the famous story of how supposedly during the filming of Meet Me in St. Louis, or St. Louis, Vincent Minnelli told Margaret O'Brien that her dog had died to get her to cry. You know, who knows if that's true either, but
it reminds me of a story I heard about a Tony winning actress who was working with a kid and grabbed the kid by the face, one hand on each side, and said, you're not giving me anything. I don't want to say who it is, but anyway, go on.
Yeah, well, anyway, that's what that reminded me of, whether that's true or not. I thought the show was a mess is kind of the best word for it. There were some things in it that I really liked. I thought it started out quite well, and I thought, oh, gee, maybe this is, you know, maybe I'm going to really love this and disagree with a lot of the reviews. I thought Christiane Knoll was wonderful as Chaplin's mother. And I thought the scene early on where he is a very young boy and they're out on the street together and she has a song to the effect of how it's called Look at All the People. And it's sort of to the effect of how everyone in the world has a story. And it's sort of, you're supposed to think it's him observing these people and starting at a very young age to observe the way people behave on the street and use that as the basis for his, you know, for his art as an actor and a director. I thought that was a great number, but then it just kind of went off the rails. I think there seems to be general agreement that it was a big mistake for them to try to do his entire life. I can't offhand think of another show that does that. There might be one or two but I don't know if any of them were hits. And even the things that I liked in one respect, I didn't like in another. I thought it was fascinating the way that they really did kind of make it seem like the whole thing was in black and white. But as Peter pointed out, in one way that they made that effect was to have the lighting be really quite dim throughout the whole show. Because, you know, I mean, the costumes may be monochrome, but there are things like actresses with yellow hair that, you know, you can still see somewhat, but because the lighting is so dim, it almost looks like a black and white film, or maybe one of those early two-strip Technicolor films. So I admired the effect, but it was a negative in the sense that it was so dark, and that just kind of added to the it didn't seem very, there were very few moments that really popped in the show. And then talk about mixed metaphors. They set up this framing device. They sort of set up this framing device where the whole show is kind of framed as a movie about Chaplin, but they do a few things to indicate that, and then they literally just stop. That's something I'm surprised that Thomas Meehan allowed to continue. I mean, either do it all the way or don't do it, don't you think? I didn't get that. Yeah. And then mixed metaphors, you know, they had a scene where Chaplin was married several times, and they realized, to their credit, that they couldn't spend any amount of time on each of those wives. So they did it in a little scene that's sort of framed as a boxing match between Chaplin and the various women. But, you know, which is fine. But what does that have to do with a movie within a movie? So that didn't work, I thought. The show kind of reminded me as an unsuccessful combination of Barnum, Will Rogers' Ooh. Follies, and Mac and Mabel. But all of those shows, especially Barnum, I mean, it's certainly not done in a realistic style. But they have, you know, but in Barnum, they're consistent in the metaphor. You know, I mean, the way it's presented, the whole thing is basically like a circus. And Will Rogers' Follies, similarly, it seemed more of a piece. It didn't seem like they were trying all these different methods to get to what they wanted to get to. The score, I thought, was forgettable. I was ultimately moved at the end of the show when the full company sang a song called This Man, which I thought was quite a lovely song. But I guess that's just because of the accumulation of the details and what you know about Chaplin, and also how he had been sort of expatriated, and then he had that comeback at the Oscars when he received a honorary Lifetime Achievement Award, which I remember watching when it actually happened. Do you remember that, Peter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was, you know, I mean, that's kind of, it's I don't think you can really stage something like that and not have it make an emotional effect on an audience, even if you've made some mistakes in the show before.
I'm surprised they didn't give him gray hair there, because he was famously gray at that point.
Yes, I remember. I had the same thought, and it would have been easy enough to just kind of slap it on his head. Yeah.
Though I did think Rob McClure aged well in terms of his own ability to be an older man. I thought he was very effective in that scene. So, but you know, did I miss something? And tell me if I did. I'm able to take it. There was after we see the boxing match, about 10 minutes later, somebody mentions his teenage brides and his infatuation with underage girls. Was it ever mentioned that those wives, at least the first two, were teenagers? In fact, they were. But I only learned that after the fact. Did that come up at all when he married those ladies, that they were teenagers? I don't remember that. And I don't think we should hear it after the fact. And the infatuation with underage girls is quite a statement, but I didn't quite see that happen either.
Oh, well, no, I mean, I don't think it was there until that that line, but I guess I just assumed they wanted to downplay it.
Yeah, you know, I have a feeling this was a show, as long as the show is, and it is 2.5 hours, I have a feeling it was substantially longer, and a lot got cut just for time purposes. Mm. And I think that's why so much of it seems so sketchy. I also hated the idea of everybody singing, "What you gonna do when it all falls down?" I think that's an unfair question for most of us. I mean, what are any of us going to do with all falls down? We do the best we can. Why is that something that people should be saying to him?
Yes, and it's interesting. Ben Brantley, in his review, said that that line reminded him of "How did you get there from here, Mr. Shepherd?"
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a big difference there, isn't there? Because how did you get there from here, or here from there, whatever the line is, that's not as negative.
No, that suggests achievement. I mean, that's kids wanting to know, how do I succeed? You know, that's what they're asking.
Well, or if not achievement, at least it's not so clearly about a fall. You know, it's not about what are you going to do when it all falls down? That's right. Such a negative thing to start a play, sure, a show with, you know?
And I'm sure it has everything to do with the fact that they thought, oh, let's put him on a tightrope. That'll be dramatic, you know? So, and it is.
Interestingly enough, we don't always know these things, but I had a friend who saw the show early in previews, and he said that in the preview that he saw, McClure did his curtain call starting on the tightrope.
Wow.
Yeah, and then they lowered him. They lowered him and the tightrope, and then he got off and did the, I guess, you know, came down and took a bow. But isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Sure.
A couple other things. I was surprised that some of the lyrics did not rhyme.
Wow, did they ever not?
And you know, I've gotten to the point where that no longer bothers me in a contemporary musical about young people, like, for example, Bring It On or Spring Awakening. But I just think in a case like this, it drives me crazy because the music is very traditional, you know, Broadway. And there was one line that I don't remember it exactly, but it rhymed do with news. N-E-W-S, and it just was nails on a chalkboard for me.
I think there's a point where screen is rhymed with string, or a word similar to that. I mean,
yeah.
Maybe it's spring, but it's something like that.
Right.
And frankly, Michael, I don't even like it when kids do it. And I also think it's bad for an audience, because it's hard enough to hear lyrics and understand lyrics when you're watching a Broadway show, especially when a chorus sings. And
right.
I really believe that every time a lyric does not land and does not rhyme, the audience has a tiny bit of confusion, and it takes away from their enjoyment of the show. Mm. And really, now, why is it the Spring Awakening, with 8 Tony Awards in a Broadway smaller theaters, why is it that with those rave reviews and with those Tony Awards and in a small house, that of all the musicals that have won Tonys this millennium, that one's runs the shortest length of time? Why is that? And I have a feeling it's because people go and they don't understand what's being said in the rhymes, and it chips away at their enjoyment. And at the end of the show, when people say, "How'd you like it?" they say, "It was all right," because they didn't understand everything. I do believe, this is a theory, it's not a pronouncement, but I do believe that it really does hurt a show when lyrics don't rhyme, because the audience needs that to know where they are.
Well, that's a fascinating subject. Maybe we can talk about that more sometime. In Spring Awakening, also, some of the lyrics are terribly enigmatic. Mm. Like in that last song and a few others, there are some things that I don't even know what they're saying. But to me, maybe it's silly, but I guess the fact that I know that that kids, that music for young people today, the style is, for better or worse, I mean, I would say worse, is not to rhyme, or to have close rhymes but not true rhyme. So,
well,
to me, that I mean, I absolutely understand. And I'll never forget, when Xana Don't, when that show came out, it drove me up the wall, because every rhyme was like not really a rhyme. But for some reason, I guess I've come to accept it in a show, literally, like that's about really young people that has, you know, is set in modern day. I've come to accept it just because in terms of verisimilitude.
I remember one time on All That Chat, somebody criticized me after I brought this issue up, saying, "Oh, perfect rhymes. Oh, they make everything so sing-songy." Well, it's a song. It's being sung. I mean, I think sing-songy is a place for, you know, for
yes.
songs. So,
yes.
Anyway.
One more thing on Chapman. I must say they did an amazing job with the copious film clips that they used. And I don't know about you, I thought it was the real Chaplin. I thought they were real films of the real Chaplin. Apparently not. They are films of recreations of scenes with Rob McClure and the other people in the cast. And they did a superb job of it, making it look like old silent film, old scratchy silent film. So for whatever that's worth, whoever did that should get, if there was a Tony Award for recreating old film, that person should get it. Really, really incredibly well done.
All right. Well, glad to hear that the season is starting off and that we have room to go. So do we think that Chaplin is going to get parodied in the next version of Forbidden Broadway?
I don't know if it'll be around long enough.
Yeah.
I was frankly surprised that the closing notice didn't go up for today. Because, as Peter said, it's a combination of things. There is no one approaching a star who's known by the general public. Some of the reviews were very, very poor, including the New York Times. It's not the subject matter is someone who's not necessarily, certainly not very high in the public consciousness today in general, and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. So kind of unfortunate.
All right, but Forbidden Broadway, the new version, did open. We talked about it as a preview briefly. We really didn't review it a few weeks back, but Peter got to see it and Michael has seen it. So, so Peter, why don't you give us your take on it so far?
Well, it's just as good as it's ever been, but the one thing that really amazes me, is how Gerard Alessandrini and Philip George can find such great talents in this town to do everything. I mean, I really think Forbidden Broadway is the hardest job in town because you have to imitate so many people and you have to make them recognizable, immediately recognizable. And this cast, people I've never heard of, Natalie Charlet Ellis, Scott Richard Foster, Jenny Lee Stern, and Marcus Stevens. I guess he has no middle name. Really, I'm amazed at how they can become all these people that we have known and loved, from Stephen Sondheim to Patti LuPone to Manny Patinkin. I think they are just superb. And while the writing, of course, is as good as ever, Gerard hasn't lost his touch whatsoever. The fact remains that these people bringing these things to life were pinpoint perfect in their interpretations and their imitations. I was just tremendously impressed. I think that the musicals that opened after March 2009 were closed by now. We're very lucky because they didn't get any Forbidden Broadway's parodies, you know, given the fact that that's when the last one closed, March 1st, 2009. So let that be their consolation. Jerry has had a few shows that have closed in this edition. He does refer to Ghost, and he does something on Anything Goes Follies, and, you know, now Porgy and Bess, you know, will soon be...
history.
Yes. leave it to Michael to finish that sentence. He can't wait for that to happen. Anyway, and Night Music, too, for that matter. You know, so, I mean, he does do recent closings, but by and large, a lot of shows got off the hook, you know. So, but, yeah, I mean, he really does a great job in spoofing how the story of Once is so badly told, that Newsies is so over the top, and Nice Work If You Can Get It is stupid, and Rock of Ages is junk, and that show that urges us all to turn off the dark has a lot of wailing in it. So it's very, very good, and I'm glad it's back. It's something that should be always here in the city. And I mean, Jerry was smart to go away, so we'd miss it enough, you know. And now that we've missed it enough, we don't have to miss it anymore. So if you've enjoyed it in the past, I will say it's just as good as ever. But very significant. This has to be the first time that Forbidden Broadway mentions by name a Tony winner who used to be part of its cast, Michael McGraw. You know, and I think that's really nice that he is mentioned by name in the Nice Work If You Can Get It parody. So that's a first, and I assume it's a first, and that's terrific.
Oh, I may have missed that. They literally say his name.
They do. They mention Judy Kaye and Michael McGraw by name.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I certainly agree with Peter about both the writing and the talent of the performers. You know, it's interesting. A lot of the recent mainstays of Forbidden Broadway are now all in musical. Another terrific off-Broadway review. People like Christina Bianco and Michael West and Christine Petty, and I think maybe one or two others. While it's always great to have those people back, you know, obviously there needs to be new blood too, and they certainly did an amazing job in this case. Marcus Stevens' impersonation of Matthew Broderick is beyond hilarious.
And that fat suit's very interesting, too.
Yes. Scott Richard Foster does an amazing Steve Kazee in once. Jenny Lee Stern, she does any number of hilarious bits, including a superannuated Annie. And Natalie Charlay Ellis does, among other things, Catherine Zeta-Jones, who I would not say is an easy person to do, but she does it brilliantly. So I was thrilled with the show. You know, full disclosure, I co-wrote the book Forbidden Broadway Behind the Mylar Curtain with Gerard. So I for whatever that's worth, but I think that that even people who have no connection with the show whatsoever would say that this is really an excellent, phenomenal comeback for them. And it's so great to have it back. I'm not sure, parenthetically, if it can be an open-ended run, because I think, if I understand correctly, that theater where they are at, the 47th Street Theater, is still owned by the... is it the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater?
Oh, yeah.
I believe I was told that they still do one show a year. So they might have to at least take a hiatus in the spring. But I'm not at all sure about that. So don't take that as gospel. But it will be interesting to see what happens, because the reviews of this one were, I think, unanimous raves. I don't recall seeing anything really less than that. And including an absolute love letter from the time. So great to have it back. Really, really fantastic.
With us this morning, we have a special guest, Mr. Bob Avian, who any Broadway fan would know is just a force in the industry who has brought us all sorts of wonderful shows, most notable being the Chorus Line. And he's worked on things such as Sunset Boulevard, Martin Guerre, and Witches of Eastwick, and Miss Saigon, and different productions of Company's Follies, Twigs, Seesaw, and God's Favorite. It just is the must-sees of Broadway. So, Bob, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us.
Well, thank you.
So tell us, you have a new production of A Chorus Line opening up in London. Tell us about that production and how exciting is that to do that?
It's very exciting. You know, we haven't been in London since the late 70s when the first time around we played. And we've been working the past couple of years trying to get London on. And we're so limited because we need a 40-foot proscenium opening, and there are only like three theaters in London that have that, the Drury Lane, the Palladium, or the Prince of Wales, believe it or not. And the Prince of Wales has Book of Mormon going in. So when
that's
the
not going anywhere.
Yeah, they can play that anywhere, right? So so luckily, the Palladium made a couple of shifts and got us able to come in and fulfill our dream of replaying the West End. So it's all very exciting, and I I hear they're excited over there. So that's all good stuff.
All right. Now, I have a question about that. I mean, given the fact that the show started downtown at the Public Theater, that's a very small space. So,
No, the Newman Theater has a 40-foot opening.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow,
and,
that's impressive.
And that's why, you know, we created it there, and it's always been the same everywhere we've played.
That's interesting, Bob. I didn't realize that about London theaters.
Yeah, they all have very small proscenium openings, like 32 feet, maybe 34. And we would not be able to stretch our line across the stage without going into the wings. So that's always been a detriment to us getting on a new production there.
Right.
All right. Now, let's go back to 1975. And there you are. You're with Michael Bennett, and he's asking for your advice. And you're his right-hand man there. Is there anything that you disagreed on violently that you said, Michael, no, that's got to be in or that's got to be out, that you would now add or subtract from this production now that Michael's no longer with us?
No. We agreed on everything pretty much. We hung out morning, afternoon, and night, you know, and we would discuss everything and every little thing. And, you know, he'd send me in one room to create something. He'd be in the other room. And it took us so long to do it. It took us a year to do it originally. And that everything was so, we came to everything so in sync that I don't remember anything being different. I have changed certain things in the show now because it's confusing to the audience. It's like in the original, when the cast would come forward and state their name, they would state what year they were born in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're sitting in the audience today and someone's saying they were born in 1946, even mm-hmm. though in the program it says takes place in 1975, yeah. it's too confusing.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I changed a couple of the references, like to movie stars and things. Not much, never in the music, but in the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And a little snip here and there.
All right.
And
now,
and some redoing of the orchestrations.
Uh-huh. All right, meaning what? More brass, what?
No, just bringing it more up to date. You know, people's ears have gotten so much more sophisticated. And now with all the electronic instruments in the pit, you can add more substance to it. It sounds pretty much the same, but it's enhanced.
All right. Now, given that you and Michael did everything hand in hand, there's that famous story of the time that he fell during that rehearsal, and everybody thought that he was truly injured, and everybody's going crazy, and then he got up and said, that's what I want to have happen when Paul falls. Did you know in advance he was going to do that?
Yeah, three of us knew he was going to do it.
Who was the other one?
Me and the stage managers, because he would say, and Donna, and he would say, I'm going to take a fall. And stage managers, Donna, go for the phone, or stage managers, Locke, go for the door, and Bobby, you just try to hold the crowd together, because we didn't want anybody to really be accessed to be for an emergency call.
Oh, sure, right, yeah.
And, you know, he did it because it took so long to stage things like that, that, no, you come in a little, you move out a little, and so you instantly know when he took the dive who are the stronger characters and who are the more confused characters, because the strong ones all ran in right away, and others just got so shocked or worried that they pulled out and withdrew. And the moment after he fell, he said to everybody, now, do you all know just what you did right now? And the scene was the scene. You know, it took us so long to do the show, but that scene, it took him 5 minutes.
All right, at that moment, when he came clean and essentially said, yeah, I staged that just so that I'd get the right reactions from you, did you feel that he had done the right thing? Did you feel that the cast was going to turn against him for doing that? I remember Bayouac Lee telling me that she was truly furious at that.
Yes, she was. A few of them were, because mm-hmm. they had felt they had been manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
But then he explained to them why he did it, and they understood. And they understood what he was going for. You know, they are actors in training as well. And, you know, sense memory and all that stuff that you do in acting class, you know, it's legit.
Yeah. Bob, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about Marvin Hamler, since obviously we lost him a few weeks ago, and specifically the collaborative process with him. That must have been just amazing.
Yeah, Marvin was amazing. And, you know, he and Michael had said this very special relationship. I guess they met each other around 1964, and they were always best pals. I worked with the two of them for the first time when I was assisting Michael on a number for a very young Liza Minnelli for the Sullivan Show coming from Vegas, and Marvin was doing the arrangement. And his talent was just so enormous. But we never got to work together again, just on TV and stuff like that, until Chorus Line. And, of course, Marvin had just won 3 Oscars for The Way We Were in The Sting. And Michael calls Marvin up and says, Marvin, I've got a show for you. You got to come to New York and do it with me. And Marvin says, great, what is it? And he says, it's called The Chorus Line, and we're all making $100 a week. And it'll probably be a year's work in rehearsal. And Marvin says, okay, I'll be there. He tells his agent, his agent's ready to kill him, and say, how can you do that? You're the king of Hollywood, and you're going to go work off Broadway? And Marvin say, well, it's Michael Bennett, you know, and I want to do this. And sure enough, he was there on the day he was needed and never left us.
I'm curious about the shows of yore. So there you were in Nowhere to Go But Up back in 1962.
Oh my God.
this was a show that only lasted a week at the Winter Garden, but I understand Dorothy Loudon was tremendous in it.
Yeah.
True, false, what?
It was a great cast. Tom Bosley, Marty Balsam, Dorothy Loudon, Bert Convy, you know, and Sidney Lumet was the director, and James Lipton was the lyricist, and then Mel Brooks came in to help. So everybody was first class. Unfortunately, and Kermit Bloomgarden was the producer.
Sure, yeah.
Unfortunately, its style got confused, I would say, as a chorus boy's perspective. We had one slant on the show in rehearsals, and then we opened with a different show and more of a cartoon version of what was there originally.
And this
but
was
I tell you, I had a lot of fun doing the show.
It was about Prohibition, right?
Yes. Izzy and Moe, two Prohibition cops. And the villain was played by this guy, Bruce Gordon, who used to be on The Untouchables.
Sure.
It was all very broad, you know, cartoon-like.
Now, when you went into Funny Girl as a performer, was Barbara Streisand still there?
Oh, yeah. I went into it. I started rehearsals 1 week after the show opened.
Uh-huh.
And I had a couple of weeks rehearsal because I was the swing for the male chorus. What a tough job that is.
Mm.
And so I stayed with it about a year. Very impressive watching that show nightly and seeing what went on down.
Meaning what? We've often heard that she got bored with it as time went on and gave inferior performances. Do you have a take on that?
No, I don't. I don't think so. She was working so hard at the same time. She was making records. She was doing concerts. She was doing TV shows. And she'd still show up at the show at night. But to make it a little easier for her, on matinee days, she'd cut an intro here or cut a ballad. That was rare, though. But she did get bored, and that's why sometimes she'd come on stage in a different costume until Ray Stark came in and said, no, 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 you got to wear the Irene Sheriff stuff. But she was fascinating to watch, and I think gave her all pretty much every night. That's my perspective, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot more time off the stage unless someone was out.
Mm-hmm. How'd you become assistant stage manager of I Do, I Do? That really happened, huh?
Yeah, you know all the nuts and bolts. Huh? I had worked with Mary as a replacement in Jenny, and then on the road tour that we played the Far East and Vietnam in Hello Dolly.
Wow, you were there, huh?
Yeah, second year of the war.
Oh wow!
And we were playing in airplane hangars for all the guys in their blue pajamas who were in the hospitals and everything, and it was like 100 degrees. The humidity was unbearable. And there we were at 9 a.m. in the morning doing Hello, Dolly on the back of trucks.
I'm sorry, Bob, did you say, were you still in it when it was in London?
No, that's when the our principals went to London, and we picked up Betty Grable and new cast the principals in the States.
Okay.
And then went to Vegas. But when I was doing Hello, Dolly, towards the end of it, I said, geez, I don't know if I want to keep dancing in the chorus. You know, what's the next step for me? And Mary and I got along so well, and she always had a stage manager on staff that just looked out for her. And so I put my name in the slot, and sure enough, they hired me to do it. But it was a very dull job.
I would think so.
We had no matinees, no understudies, and so it really, the repetition got to be really boring. And then Michael, who was like one of my best friends, and he said, I'm doing my second Broadway show. Please come and do it with us. And I went, oh, okay. And it was the right choice, I tell you.
All right, so that was Henry Sweet Henry, right?
Yes.
Had you seen his work on Joyful Noise, which supposedly was terrific?
No, I didn't.
Uh-huh.
I was, I guess, on a show at the same time. It only played a week in New York.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so I never saw it. But I saw the numbers. They'd always do them around playing around in rehearsal.
So, Bob, how do you account for this incredible streak of wonderful shows that you were involved with? And how is how is Broadway different these days than it was when you were a performer and how your career transitioned?
I don't know. I look back on it. You know, in the 60s, it was still in the tradition of all old Broadway shows where you had a singing chorus and a dancing chorus. Not for West Side Story or Hair or those breakthrough shows, but the traditional shows. And the audience was very accepting of the style of those shows. They still are today. There's no difference. I mean, we still have things like that. But I don't know. I was lucky enough to be a dancer at that time. So I call that my first third of my career, and the second third was my Michael Bennett years, where we just hit it off so well as friends that being his assistant, I was not a paid assistant. I was, of course, but I was his best friend, and so we could be so honest with each other about everything. And then I had his whole career, and people would say to me, why don't you go off and do it on your own? I said, it doesn't get better than this. And, you know, because Michael's work was so stunning. And then when he died, of course, I thought, oh, I'm never going to work again. And I was so distraught by the whole, that period of losing so many friends. And then Cameron McIntosh called me and asked me to be part of the British Invasion. And I just wound up doing like 6 shows for him and 1 for Andrew. And I went, wow, I never thought this was going to happen in my life.
Mm.
So it's great to have the perspective of all 3 times in our theater history.
Yeah, going to Coco, it's often been said that Michael Bennett really took over the direction from Michael Benthal. If you had to give a percentage of what part of the direction, not choreography now, direction, Michael actually did, what would you say?
50%.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And Katharine Hepburn did a lot of it, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael Benthal, unfortunately, was not great at the time, you know, and he had personal issues, and he was afraid of the show, and he was afraid of handling, didn't know how to handle the big scenes with a lot of people, and it was very intimidating, and he would just be hiding out, and so Michael would be off doing big book scenes, and I'm going, wait, we need you in here. And he said, just do it. And then Hepburn would take over lots of times, and it was a tough show to get through, I tell you. It was one of the roughest.
Because?
Because she was not a natural musical theater performer.
Yeah.
And yeah, just to get her to do anything was very difficult. Mm. At one whole production number, we just sat around the edge of the stage. So she could be like 2 feet from the conductor, and the orchestra would go, da-dum-ba-dum-bum-bum, well, the money rings out, you know. And
That was a good imitation, by the way.
Yeah. And we're going, oh my God, you know. And she was bossy. And if you wanted her to come down the stairs and cross the stage right, you go, no, I can't do that. And so we started thinking, well, how do we get her to do what we want her to do? We tell her the opposite. And half the time we did that, you know. And it was tough. It was tough. And Cecil Beaton wasn't around, and that huge beige set. It was the hardest thing to light in the whole world. And you know, it was tough. But the cast was brilliant. They were wonderful people, and the girls were stunning. And when I look back at a Tony Award, say, tape of Always Mademoiselle, mm-hmm. I go, wow, that was great. Mm-hmm. You know, but unfortunately, she wasn't so great.
Mm-hmm. When Michael was summoned to Detroit for Seesaw, were you on the seat next to him in the plane? Did you go on first trip?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you agree with him about the Lainey Kazan firing?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Funny Girl with Lainey, and I saw her go on and do all of that.
That's right, but yeah.
She was supposed to be a dancer, you know, mm-hmm. and Lainey's softic, and oh boy, I guess we let most of the cast go, and then the creators left, and there we were stuck with it all because of Joe Kipnis, you know, crying Joe Kipnis, who's like, oh Michael, I need you, like, I don't want to have a flop, you know, and he did his act, and we all fell for it, and that's why we were there.
Wow, you really feel the crying was an act. I mean, I remember...
No, it was sincere, but he could summon up those tears so quickly, you know.
Uh-huh. I remember so vividly a line that he said at the time. It was quoted in the Times. He said to Michael, you have to come in because whenever another Broadway show dies, Broadway itself dies a little. And I remember nodding at that and saying there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
Especially in those days when there wasn't a lot, right? I mean, wasn't that a kind of a not
it
a
wasn't,
great
yeah,
era?
Right. It really was. That's a good point, too. I guess what we envy you most, Mr. Avian, is that you got to see Follies a lot, didn't you?
A lot. That was a heartbreaking experience, though. Because,
yeah.
You know, we were open, and you know, we had done Company the year before, and of mm-hmm. course, that was thrilling for me, just sitting watching rehearsals or to see a concept musical like this take off with this great talent. I mean, my jaw was hanging open most of the time. I just loved working on that show. And then Follies was very difficult to put together because so many of the performers were old and they couldn't remember things, and it was hard. And the script was very, it was all about American angst. And you're going, oh my God, how's this all going to work? But we were certainly proud of it. And then we open in Boston, and you know, it's sitting there in its glorious way. And people are getting up and walking out of the theater as they had done with Company as well. Mm-hmm. And then we get these very mixed reviews. And we keep working on it, and we put in what is now the famous opening, closing night in Boston. We pulled it back together, and redid it. And we opened in New York, and they were tough on us. They were really tough on us, and Hal kept it running. You know, with a third of a house, he kept it running for 9 months. But now, you know, now it has its time.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that because I'm from Boston and I saw it there. But that also reminds me of Company. I've told this story a lot. I was at the first performance of Company, and when Dean Jones was singing Happily Ever After, I remember so vividly his eyes widening. And I really got the impression that's when he made the decision he was going to quit, because he really felt that the audience was not with him at all. Years later, I asked him about it, and he actually said that that actually happened to him. He said, I looked at that audience, and I was thinking, why do you hate me so much? So I do remember that vividly. And do you recall any strife with him when you knew he was going to leave? Was he difficult about it? Was he nice about it?
He was very easy to work with, mm-hmm. and he was really good in the role. He would just be on stage all night long watching all these other actors land, in their big numbers, you know, or their big comedy routines, and then comment on it, and never had the payoff, you know, and that was difficult for him. I understood that. And he was not a Broadway person in terms of having the perspective of seeing it from outside of that.
Well, a lot of that problem is, you know, some of it is inherent in the role of Bobby, you know,
as has
been pointed out. And also, yeah, that's interesting. I also spoke with Gene Jones years later, and he, as I think it's fairly well known, that he said that at least part of the reason why he left was that his own marriage was breaking up at the time. Isn't that
right? Oh, okay. Good point.
Yeah. And I said something to the effect of, well, in a way, I would almost think that maybe you could have used the show as a catharsis for that. And he said, well, if I had been able to use that as an actor, but at that point, you know, in my life, I really wasn't able to do that.
Yeah. But he was very flexible and easy to work with. He never gave any attitude. But you knew he was unhappy, you know, and he was very closed off. So, and, you know, when you have Elaine Stritch in rehearsal and Barbara Barry, it's very hard to get in any of your own two cents, you know?
Bob, can you tell us a little bit about your experience with Dreamgirls?
Oh, wow. Well, Tom Ion approached me on the street, and he thought I was Michael Bennett. And he said, I have got this great show for you. And he started telling me about it. And I was going, ooh, it sounds so good. So I told Michael about it. And Michael said, we just turned down a show for Motown. They would have given us the catalog and we could have done anything. I said, I know, but this sounds good. So brought Tom in. And Tom went, oh, you're Michael Bennett. And anyway, so we took it on as producers of workshops. So we let Tom do the first workshop, and we brought in Michael Peters to be the choreographer, and we let him do the second workshop. And the first workshop had Jennifer. The second workshop had, what was her name?
Brenda Presley. Was it Brenda Presley?
No. She was an understudy in New York. She was a girl in the movie of Hair from Milos Forman. I can't remember her name.
Nell Carter.
And that, No.
sorry. No.
Sorry, this girl I haven't seen since. Anyway, and we weren't getting anywhere. We weren't getting anywhere at all. And Tom liked the actress to improvise, so get the book right. But the second act was becoming, Effie became a nurse with this old woman and wasn't singing anymore, and plots like that. And third workshop, Michael took over and said, Tom, you write. You can't write and direct and do it all. And the third workshop, we took it over, and we just had them sit at a table. And we wrote the show with the cast sitting at the table for, I think, 5 weeks. And then it was, I think, Jennifer Lewis playing Effie. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth workshop, we started getting it up on its feet, and we got Jennifer Holiday back. But right before we were about to sell it and audition it for John Kluge and the Schuberts and David Geffen, Jennifer left us. Just went by, and she was out. So we go, who do we get to do this? And so we asked Elena Morrison? Morris, whatever. Elena
Warren?
No, Morrison. Okay. I don't know. She was on a sitcom. Anyway, so she learned the show in about 3 days. And when we sold the show, we just did it at table with microphones as opposed to staged. And they bought it, and she was so wonderful, Elena, just getting us through this. Elena Reed.
And, oh, yes. She was in Chicago.
Yeah, and she was great person to help us do this, and she delivered for us, and that was it. And David said yes, the Schubert said yes, John Kluge said yes, and we had our money. And then we, when the time was right, we went into rehearsal. But we had a whole new show then. Yeah.
Well, you know, Bob. Now they're going to do a musical about Motown. Did they ask you to do it?
No.
Speaking of workshops,
Tasha Katz is doing. Interesting. The guy who's directing,
yes,
the musical about Motown was in our dance chorus of Dreamgirls. Huh. Charles Randolph Wright.
Huh. Oh yeah.
Very
Speaking
nice
of workshops, you were there for Scandal, the show that almost happened with Susie Kurtz. And So what's your main memory of Scandal when you think of being in that rehearsal room and getting as far as you did? What can you tell us about Scandal? Because that's the one we're curious about.
Well, you know, it was a dance show. It was all about the dancing. Mm. The whole company were dancers, except for the principals. And it was... You know what it was about. It was about a woman who takes revenge on her husband who's messing around and screwing everybody. And she goes, if a guy can do this, a girl can do this. And she goes off to Europe and meets all these men and has these wild affairs with them all. But we, as choreographers, did like five incredible ballets for this, or dance numbers in some sequences, that were very extensive and very long. And one was an American woman in Paris, and one was took place in the Alps while accusing her of being sinful, and just a hotel fire sequence and all these wonderful things. But it never came together. We just didn't have a show that was finished from A to Z, and we didn't have a score that was finished from A to Z, and we ran out of workshop time. So, and then AIDS was hitting. And here's the show about a woman who's going off to flex her muscles in the sexual world, and people are dropping dead, you know. Yeah. So it all was wrong.
I remember vividly the day that Michael died, July 2nd, 1987, I was flying to Vienna, and when I got off the plane, what I always do is see what's playing in town and opened up the paper, and there was an ad for a Chorus Line. It wasn't playing then, but right. It was coming to Vienna at that point, and it was just so eerie to see that after knowing earlier that morning that he had died. When he must have confided in you very early that he was very sick.
Yeah, the day he found out, I found out.
I see.
And then the next 6 months, we flew all over America to go to different programs that they were contemplating. It was a miserable time.
Of course. Sure.
And, you know, we'd go to Minneapolis. This one doctor was trying these experiments with using siblings' blood. And then we would go to Rochester for something else. And we wound up in Houston. And the doctor there says, nope, we have no cure. You're going to die. And I'm thinking, oh, my God.
You know, there I was saying about Seesaw that when a Broadway musical dies, Broadway dies a little. But when Michael Bennett died, Broadway died a lot, didn't it?
Yeah. He had so many gifts. And it was so interesting. I was in London doing the London Follies. And I'd speak to him every morning on the phone in Tucson, where he was living his final months. And it was so difficult. He didn't want to know anything about my work. And I couldn't say to him, how you doing today? How are you feeling? Because it was so difficult. But we'd just get on the phone and stumble through. But I remember we were in this tech rehearsal and nothing was working, and it was 100 degrees, and all of a sudden I feel this hand on my shoulder, and it's Cameron, and he goes, we just lost Michael. Oh, it was so terrible. It was so awful. Mm. A horrible time. Anyway.
So, you're back to Europe soon.
Yes. Bayork goes the end of the month to cull the herd, so to speak, and then I go in November and do all the final auditions, and hopefully we'll wind up a wonderful show. And we go into rehearsals January 2nd, and opening night is February 19th.
And we should mention for those of us who can't get to London that the Paper Mill Playhouse is about to revive Chorus Line again. And
there's
some interesting things with this show. It says that it's directed and choreographed by Mitzi Hamilton, one of the dancers in Bennett's original taped workshop that inspired it. And also you have they have Jessica Lee Golden. Who was in your revival. And then also Rochelle Rack, who is very, very prominently featured in
Every Little Step.
Every Little Step, yes, thank you. The documentary about the revival, which was, I really loved that movie, Bob.
It came out great. I was so happy when I saw it. I went, oh, my God.
So Rochelle is very prominently featured as being continually called back for was it for Sheila?
Yes.
Yeah, and not getting it, and really kind of basically saying, "Well, am I? You know, do you want me or not?"
Yes, so very demanding. Yes.
So it will be very interesting for many of us to see her play the role in Paper.
Right.
So it's going to be going into previews on February 2nd at the Palladium, opening February 19th, as you mentioned. And they already have it's a strictly limited run through June 29th.
Yeah.
So if you are going to get out to London to go see it, book your tickets now.
There you go.
Bob, thank you so much for getting up and talking with us and sharing with us on a Sunday morning. We really appreciate you visiting with us.
All right. My pleasure. It was fun. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, take Bob. Care. Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow, that was some conversation with Bob. Every week, you guys, Peter, Michael, and whoever's out here, is I learned something new, and it's really impressive. Thank you so much for Peter and Michael for really bringing that every week to us. So what's coming up, Peter and Michael, for you? Anything coming up this week?
Not a thing for me, I don't think. I may try to go to Fly Me to the Moon. I'm interested in the play at the Metropolitan Playhouse, Both Your Houses, which was a political play back, I think, in the 30s. It didn't last very long, but it dealt with a lot of issues that we're dealing with today in terms of politics and the way the races are run. So I'm interested in that. So I think I may go to that this week, but nothing firm yet. You know, the things haven't really perked up quite yet. So we'll see.
Well, I am seeing the Jake Gyllenhaal play on Friday.
Oh, yes. Actually, I am too on Saturday. Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that should certainly be interesting. Peter, what's Fly Me to the Moon?
It's a play at 59 East 59th that Marie Jones.
Oh, right. Yes.
The lady
yes.
wrote Stones in Her Pocket. I'm going to try to go this week, and because that's I enjoyed Stones in His Pockets very much, and I'm hoping this will be just as good.
That's great.
And coming up, briefly, shortly thereafter, there's a revisal, of Marry Me a Little. It's going to be at the Clermont on Theater Row with some new songs in it, some new Sondheim songs. Marry Me a Little is a show that was put together from years ago, 92, is that right?
Or was it even earlier than that?
Earlier than that, I'm sorry. Yeah. With shows, Sondheim, songs from Sondheim shows that were very obscure at the time and since then have become less obscure. But they're doing a revival of that and with Lauren Molina and Jason Tam, who, to bring this full circle, was in the revival of Chorus Line that Bob directed.
Have you guys seen Lauren Molina's Skivvies?
I'm sorry.
Yes. You got a little dead air as a result of that one.
I don't mean I'm sorry that I saw them. I mean I'm sorry. What do you mean?
She has a YouTube thing called Skivvies. It's let me see if I can find it. So maybe
well, you're
I'm
gonna
crazy.
Have to link to that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Link to it.
Yeah, the Skivvies. There it is. Okay, well, we're going to put that in the show notes, and you could, of course, can read the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com. There we have links and Skivvies for all the different things we talk about each week. And you can find all of our back episodes, plus contact information for Peter, Michael, and me there. So if you want to get in touch with us. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast there. And that way, if you subscribe, that way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you, and you won't miss anything. Please go to iTunes and leave us some feedback, because the more feedback that you leave for us, the better Apple will promote this broadcast, and we'll get more fans, and more fans is more fun. So yeah, so the Skivvies, which is a bunch of Broadway folks who play instruments and sing in their underwear on YouTube. It's very funny and very talented and poignant. And so I'll link to that and put it on the show notes page.
Oh, I did see one of those. Is it at Joe's Pub?
These are taped all over the place. They did a show at Joe's Pub though as well.
Yeah, there was one with Wesley Taylor that I saw.
Yeah,
that's right.
I thought for a moment there I had totally made that up. when you guys had total blankness. So, all right. So, anyway, we will see you next week. And we're thinking about talking of a few things. I had a list here and I'm vamping so I can find it. Oh, The Train Driver at Signature, Heartless at Signature. Michael saw pieces. We talked with Peter about it last week. We also have some CDs coming up. Laura Osnes, as we talked about with Van last week, and Desert Song has got a reissue, and Call Me Madam has also got something. So,
and also Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and Pipe Dream from Oliver.
Yeah, yeah.
We could have a whole episode just on CDs. So
yeah,
over the next couple of weeks, we'll hit on all those topics and more, and maybe get a little cooch going as well. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Good.
Give me a job and you instantly get me involved. If you give me a job, then the rest of the crap will get solved. Put me to work, you would think that by now I'm allowed. I'll do you proud. Throw me a rope to grab onto. Help me to prove that I'm strong. Give me the chance to look forward to saying, hey, listen, they're playing my song. Blow.